Hey, martial arts fan, are you ready to get your guts kicked out? Thunder kick. Get ready. The Cannon Group has just given you a dare. Dare you face the kick. Dare you face the biggest karate kung fu blockbuster of them all. Kung fu. Kung fu. Are you ready to get your... Thunder kick. See ya. The biggest karate kung fu blockbuster of them all is the biggest kick of all.
This is Rachel Solomon, DJ Sonrisa of WRIR 97.3 FM's late night hip hop and electronic music program, Transmissions from Satellite 973. A pioneer in the art of song sampling, hip hop legend and Bay Area hero Josh Davis, better known as DJ Shadow, has been innovating the music world for more than 20 years. He's probably most well known for his 1996 album Introducing, the first known record to be comprised entirely of samples, which range from funky drum loops to ethereal melodies to snippets from film dialogue. Refusing to settle in just one realm of hip-hop, DJ Shadow has embraced his native San Francisco hyphy culture in some of his other work, and continually blends current music trends into his ever-evolving signature sound. He has been both lauded and criticized for his chameleon-like career approach, most recently facing a controversial upset for being kicked off stage at a Miami venue for being, quote, too future. Preston Mattson, host of WRIR's Altered Circuitry, and I spoke with Davis to learn more about his current take on the growing experimental hip-hop and electronic scene, and to find out some long-awaited answers to questions we both had as avid fans of his work. The following phone interview was recorded at WRIR LPFM Studios in Richmond, Virginia, on Wednesday, March 27, 2013. One day before his high-energy DJ set in nearby Charlottesville, Virginia.
Thank you for doing what you do.
Yeah, it's an incredible opportunity.
All right, so I'm Rachel, and...
I'm Preston. So, how's the tour been going?
Well, good. I mean, you know, it's been kind of on and off ever since 2010. I mean, it's two different tours now, but... there really wasn't a whole lot of break between the two. There was like maybe 2 months, I guess. But it's not relentless in the sense that it's not like me on a bus, you know, month after month after month. It's kind of just, I just did 3 weeks overseas. And now I'm just doing, you know, three in a row here, and then I'm home for a week, and then I do one on the weekend in San Fran, and then dip out again for three. So it's manageable. It's fine.
When you're saying the two tours, are you referring to the Shadow Sphere and then also the All Bases Covered?
Correct, yeah. So what happened was I wrapped up the Shadow Sphere tour April 28th of 2012. And then I really didn't think I was going to be playing out possibly for the rest of the year. I mean, I knew it was time for the Shadow Sphere tour to be done because, you know, we had pretty much played everywhere we wanted to play. We had done everything we wanted to do with it.
Davis continued to explain how the nature of his most recent All Bases Covered tour has been a refreshing change from shows in recent years, in which he's only played his own material. He cites a specific recent gig at Low End Theory in Los Angeles as a perfect example of how this new format has brought him back to his roots as a disc jockey.
it was an opportunity to do something that I hadn't done in a really, really long time, which was just put a set together for a club, you know, a set that, you know, they didn't give me any restrictions. They just said, yeah, do whatever you want to do. But what I really wanted to do was showcase some of the music that I had been taking in while I was touring. You know, it gave me an opportunity, as every big tour does, to kind of travel the world and listen to what other DJs are doing, especially at festivals when you're going from stage to stage and you hear the people before you and you see the people after you and you're seeing what they're doing and how they're doing it. And over the course of that 2 years of the Shadowsphere tour, I was like, wow, you know, I started downloading more and more music and listening to it and being exposed to all different kinds of beats, and I really wanted to showcase my respect for what people are doing right now in all different genres. And the set was really fun to put together and do, and it just made me want to do more. And so I told my agent, you know, hey, I'll do some DJ dates, and then it just ended up kind of snowballing. And what's really good about it is it's allowed me to play a lot of places. Like, for example, right now I'm in Athens, Georgia, and I don't think I'd ever be able to afford to do the Shadowsphere tour here. Mm. So it gives me a lot of opportunity, because it's just me and because I'm DJing and there isn't a whole big production behind it, it gives me an opportunity to play in places I'd never be able to otherwise.
That's very cool. Do you have any specific artists or specific sounds that you encountered on your tour overseas and, you know, within the States that you think really influenced the set that you've been performing with All Bases Covered?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you really kind of blow up from 2010 till now, I mean, entire genres have kind of blown up and withered and died. I mean, it's moving very quickly right now, which is great. I mean, you know, 2 years ago, you couldn't do a trap set, really, unless you were just playing, you know, southern beats, which is what, you know, trap is inspired by anyway. And, you know, 2011 was the summer of dubstep, and now it's pretty much in the kind of wobble sense of dubstep, it's kind of had its day and expired, and new things have come out to replace it, and the people that were doing those beats are doing different things now, so a little bit of everything. I mean, just, you know, I think Hudson Mohawk was a huge kind of genesis for a lot of sounds that we're hearing right now. The stuff he was doing was ahead of its time, and a lot of people have picked up on that kind of, I don't know, just kind of weird noise aesthetic and with really hard beats. And a lot of the beats that people are doing now kind of do take me back to, you know, my roots within hip-hop. You know, because sometimes electronic music kind of follows a housey thread or a thread that I can't really relate as much to. But I think at the moment it's kind of gone back to kind of a grimy, dirtier sensibility, which I definitely can relate more to.
Because of your hyphy background?
Well, I mean, hyphy is just one super tiny, you know, branch. I don't even know if I'd call it a branch from the tree of hip-hop. It's more like a twig, really. But it was just our regional take on, you know, because the Bay Area, the crunk stuff doesn't really work. I mean, as much as I like a lot of that early kind of 2000 southern crunk sound, it doesn't really translate as well in the Bay Area, just for whatever reason. It doesn't seem to fit the energy. Or as someone once said to me, the drugs are different. And hyphy was just kind of a little more amped up, a little more hyper kind of take on some of the crunk energy. So, I mean, you know, hyphy was just one other brick in the wall, but to me it goes all the way back to the early 80s and even before that, just with a lot of the stuff that I was drawn to growing up as a kid.
Do you think that, like, this rise of trap as a genre label and this whole new wave of electronica we're seeing coming out, do you think that this is an opportunity for instrumental hip-hop to make a comeback?
Well, I don't know. I've been thinking a little bit about that. I mean, I think that certainly for some people that like playing, you know, because a lot of the energy of trap music is kind of, it's kind of like a 3-6 Mafia kind of, you know, Dirty South type of musical approach, but then there's definitely a different type of spin on top of it. And even within trap itself, I mean, there's kind of small room kind of dark kind of trap stuff, and then there's kind of more rave trap, which is designed for festivals. And I mean, I'm not going to sit here like I'm some authority on the subject, but I mean, I think that some of what attracts people to it is, you know, sometimes the subject matter of a lot of hip hop, as you know, it can wear a little thin after a while, I think, for some people. And in some cases, you like the music and what it's doing and the energy it's bringing, but you know, in some cases, it's kind of like, in some cases, it almost seems like the rap kind of drags down the proceedings in some way. So I don't know. It's just certainly I still play a fair amount of rap and traditional Southern. I feel it's important, you know, just given my roots, I like to try and support rap where I can, and you know, or hip hop, whatever you want to say. But to me, rap has actually rapping in it, whereas hip hop can, as you say, be instrumental. So I don't personally like to just do instrumental. I like to throw rap in there because I like people to be reminded of the roots of the culture of it. And I like to support quality rap of any style. I'm not easily offended personally by the subject matter and never have been, whether it was NWA or whoever. I mean, I'm not, that's not really my, I'm not easily offended by it.
Mm-hmm. So while we're on the subject, how's the Bay Area scene these days? Is that something you still feel really connected to?
Sure, but I mean, the scene as always is very diverse. I mean, you have so many different, you know, are you talking hip-hop? Are you talking more club stuff, rock? I mean, as always, as with any major metropolitan hub, you're going to have all kinds of scenes kind of emerging and converging at different times. I mean, the Bay Area seems pretty vital. I mean, I would say California in general is pretty vital, although for the first time in a long time, I feel like L.A. has more going on. A lot of the beat makers that I'm hearing that I like are from L.A., and that's influencing what's happening in the Bay, I would say. But I feel like New York is strong right now, L.A. is strong right now. And then in terms of Europe, it seems like it could just as easily be somewhere in Siberia or Poland or, you know, wherever, then it could be London or Manchester. You know, it always just depends. But I think one thing about the Internet is that access has given a lot of different people in a lot of different places the ability to get their music out there, and that's definitely a good thing.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's interesting that you would mention L.A. because I noticed that you've done a show with Gaslamp Killer, I'm correct?
Sure, yeah. Well, he was touring with me for a little while.
Yeah, and, you know, I've noticed that I wouldn't say it's anywhere near being the same fashion, but in a similar fashion, he and some of his Brainfeeder label mates are, you know, infusing psychedelic sounds and metal sounds and world sounds into their brand of hip hop and electronic music. And I was wondering if there's any up and comers into this new kind of fused together experimental hip hop electronic world that you're really excited to see take off.
Well, a lot of the people, you know, I mentioned Low End Theory, and of course, that's where a lot of the, that's where Gaslamp Killer, you know, Flying Lotus, a lot of the people that are now kind of breaking as artists in their own right emerged from that scene, and it's been hugely influential for the California club scene, for sure, and it's only spread. I mean, you know, of course, you have what Lucky Me is doing and their parties, and it's, you know, there's a kinship with these different club nights around the world where it's like, it's almost like genre really isn't even discussed. It's not something that people really care about. And usually the clubs are small enough to where it's not really essential that you have these, you know, massive drops or these huge kind of club bombs or big room kind of bombs. Because, you know, the rooms are generally speaking kind of small, like Low End Theory LA, it's tiny. But it's a great room where you're going to hear, on any given night, you're going to hear, you know, like some super grimy kind of rap stuff right up against kind of psychedelic jazz up next to this or that. But it's never pretentious, and that's the key. There's never a pretension to what people are doing. And it's just been, you know, like I said, a big influence, especially on myself. And I like any movement that celebrates, you know, a kind of openness or a kind of free-form, add-your-own-personality kind of aesthetic. That's what Moax was all about. I mean, you know, taking it back 20 years. When we used to play, it was, you know, I'd do my hip-hop thing, and I'd play some Funk 45s, which was, you know, not really done back then. But we'd also drop a brand new Junglist record, or Lavelle would play like a new Detroit techno record. You know, we would totally mix it up, and it was new, it was old, it was this, it was that. But the only thing it wasn't was mainstream, you know, and that's what I like about what they're doing in LA, and that's what I like about the sets that I'm putting together, frankly, because it's just a chance for me to be like, okay, here's this guy, Salva, that I really like. Here's, you know, this guy, Mr. Carmack, that I saw at Low End that's, like, coming up, you know, on Bandcamp. Here's this beat maker from Russia that I bumped into when I was in St. Petersburg. Here's, you know, all this stuff. And it doesn't really matter to most people in the club who the artists are. It just matters that they're hearing something fresh and different, and it doesn't sound like the music they're hearing on advertisements. It doesn't sound like music they're hearing on the radio. It sounds like an assortment of music that's pushing boundaries.
The Lavelle Davis spoke of was James Lavelle, his longtime collaborator and a co-founder of the Moax record label, on which several of Davis's projects were released. Lavelle is also known for spearheading the group Uncle, for whom DJ Shadow produced the 1998 album Science Fiction, the group's acclaimed debut record. As the conversation progressed, Preston and I made sure to ask DJ Shadow some questions we'd both been harboring long before the opportunity to interview him presented itself.
We're both big fans of the stuff that you've done in the past with Cut Chemist, and I know you're talking about how you've kind of like gone in this different direction. Do you think that you would ever do another collaboration with him?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a possibility. I mean, we've worked together, obviously, on numerous occasions in the past. I mean, I've always looked at our relationship as kind of like we're brothers in the sense that we can go 2-3 years without really even so much as talking to each other and then get back together and put something really interesting down. It just depends on what's going on in his life, what's going on in my life. But musically, we're very closely aligned, I think, at least historically. And like I say, I haven't even talked to him for probably over a year, but I'm sure whatever he's up to, it's going to be compelling and interesting. I'm starting to germinate some ideas for another 45 set. And then, you know, when the time's right, I'll just see if he's interested.
Yeah, the 45 thing is awesome.
It's fun, and it's something that, you know, what's really funny, though, is that when we did the Hard Sell, which was the last time we did it in 07, 08, the last time we did a 45 set together. So that's already been 5 years, you know, since we played together. I remember at the time thinking, like, half the time when we're playing, like, audiences don't seem to really get what we're doing or they don't really seem to be that interested. And then as soon as we quit, as soon as we, you know, just felt that it had run its course and we stopped doing it, all of a sudden, all these promoters and all these, it's just like, when are you guys going to come and do the 45 thing? And we were just kind of like, damn, we just, you know, like we did it for a year and we felt like it was sort of lukewarm and now everybody wants it. It's just one of those cyclical things, you know, it comes around. And maybe also I think because maybe now, you know, people are kind of realizing that it is kind of rare. I mean, you don't generally go out and see two DJs with 8 turntables playing all 45s and, you know, doing all these crazy tricks with them and stuff like that. Maybe it's kind of maybe now it's like people are kind of like, oh, you know, that would seem really fresh right about now. So probably by the time we actually get together and do it, people will be disinterested again.
Well, I'm sure the Milk and Cookies would help you get those gigs back if they've seen your live DVDs.
Yeah. No, I know.
Yeah, I got to ask, this is just something that both of us have been really curious about. What do you happen to know or have a hunch of what the rarest 45 or just LP you've ever scratched has been?
Well, I mean, when you've been collecting long enough, you realize how many one-of-a-kind records there are, and they can be acetates, they can be test pressings, or they can just be something that's only known by one copy. I mean, literally today, a friend directed me to a link to a Funk 45 that is previously unknown, and it's not an acetate, it's not a test pressing, it was mass-produced. It's, you know, it's got a fully designed label and everything, and who knows how many they made. Maybe they only made 200, and 199 of them got destroyed in a fire or something, who knows. But my point is, after a while, you really don't think in terms of, there's no such thing as the rarest, in my opinion, because there's thousands of records out there that exist in one copy. So, I don't know. I don't even really think about stuff like that anymore. But, I mean, when it's time to put a set together, all consideration of, you know, oh, this is a rare artifact kind of goes out the window, because to me that's a bit silly, you know, especially as a DJ. If I'm going to be collecting records, you know, if I have an opportunity to use it and share the music, then I'm going to do that.
Well, yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it too. But, you know, I feel like there has been a little bit of opposition regarding that, and then regarding, you know, your use of samples. What do you feel like the biggest opposition you've had as a DJ has been throughout your career?
Well, I think any opposition I've ever had for any kind of set that I've put together or decision that I've made regarding collaborators or the type of music that I make usually has to do with the same thing, which is a segment of people not being ready to switch. And I was thinking a fair amount about how through the years, you know, there's always going to be people who make music whose eyes have been opened in some way, and they decide to follow that muse, and then have a segment of their fan base react against it. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't want to compare anything I do to the likes of, like, a Bob Dylan going electric or anything like that. But you can think about things like, you know, for example, the perennial prog rock band Rush, around about 90, when they had this type of rap in a song that they did, and I remember you know, listening to this rock station and hearing people rail against it because, you know, rap was just at that time the antithesis of what rock and roll was supposed to represent, even though ironically, of course, it wasn't the antithesis. It was the exact same thing. But, you know, you're always going to have people that are just like, I don't want that. I'm not ready. I'm not ready to move forward. I like where I'm at. But I always have felt that my job as an artist, I can't listen to that. The only barometer I can listen to or follow is my own heart and my own ideas about music and what makes music compelling. So after a while, honestly, you kind of get used to it. You kind of just, you try to be sympathetic to people's, you know, notions of what makes you you. But obviously, as soon as I start letting other people define who I am, then I'm pretty much done as an artist in terms of doing anything interesting, I feel like. So that's the best answer I can give, is that generally speaking, the opposition comes in the form of, wait, I thought you were about this. Mm-hmm. If you're about this too, then my whole vision of you is shattered. And when you think about it and you put it in those terms, it's kind of silly to follow anybody else's construct of what you are or what you should be. You have to follow your own.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm going to kind of switch gears here for a second to another thing that we've both been wondering about for a very long time. What is the song that you sample at the beginning of Fixed Income, or I guess throughout, that kind of pulsating bass sound?
The phone cut out when you said the track. What was the track?
Fixed Income.
Oh, Fixed Income. The pulse sound.
Womp, womp, yeah.
Honestly, I don't remember. And I'm not just saying that to throw. I could care less if people know what I used or not.
Yeah, sure.
But I honestly don't remember. I what actually popped into my brain was the moment when I started making the track, which was in a hotel room in London in the summer of 2000. And I remember where I was sitting and the desk I was working on. But I honestly don't remember what record I queued up to get that sound off of. I'm sure if I had some time I could think of it, but at the moment it's not coming to me.
I have another, this is a very specific sample question. I've just been wondering, since I've been listening to Introducing so much, who Bob Wood, how you found that sample of Bob Wood, the director of the Chum Group.
Right. Well, it was just some record that I bought at, you know, the store on the cover of Introducing.
Mm-hmm.
I found it there, and I didn't know what Chum was. I didn't know who he was. I just thought it was a funny, I don't know, you know. I have kind of a weird sense of humor, and I just thought it was, it would be a funny, silly way to start off the record. But parenthetically, I mean, I remember doing a show in Toronto, I think around 99, and Bob Wood was supposed to come and introduce me. He was going to introduce my set that night because somebody figured out, you know, that who he was and contacted him, and he was going to intro me on stage, which I thought was going to be awesome. But then he got sick or something, and he couldn't
Aww.
Do it. So, yeah, I mean, the Chum Group, it's Canadian radio. I forget exactly what Chum stands for, but I think it's like the national Canadian radio service or whatever.
Oh, okay.
What's next? Do you have any plans for what you're going to be doing immediately after this tour?
I'm doing things off and on until I know through August, but then I think the plan is to kind of hang it up around September because mm-hmm. I really do need to kind of get back in music making mode and start working on whatever the next album will be. So that's what I'll be doing. I mean, as soon as I kind of get my fill of what I'm doing now, I'll stop and switch up again and get back into making beats.
Excellent. So do you think you're going to be releasing a DVD of either the Shadowsphere tour or the All Bases Covered tour?
Definitely not the All Bases Covered tour, just because there's not really a strong visual element to go
sure.
with it. I mean, the All Bases Covered tour, I mean, the music's constantly changing. I mean, I'm changing stuff literally right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'll probably just release the set periodically on SoundCloud or something for free. But in terms of the Shadowsphere tour, there was a plan to do a DVD, but it has a sad ending involving hard drives being corrupted, which has nothing to do with me, by the way. So sadly, at the moment, we were supposed to, you know, there was supposed to be a DVD in the best of box of the Shadowsphere tour, but I don't know I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Okay, well, yeah, Josh, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. This is a dream come true.
Oh, well,
seriously.
Thanks.
Just
yeah
it's just
so
wonderful.
Much.
And we're hoping we can make it out to Charlottesville tomorrow to see you,
see
this leg of the tour.
Although we briefly touched on his frequent collaboration with Jurassic 5 alum Cut Chemist, DJ Shadow is also strongly affiliated with fellow members of the Quantum MC's DJ Collective, revered artists like Blackalicious, Lyrics Born, and Latif the Truth Speaker. More information about DJ Shadow's career is available at rachelsolomon.wordpress.com/blog. This interview was recorded and produced at WRIRLP 97.3 FM Studios by Rachel Solomon and Preston Matson. This content is not to be reproduced with commercial intent. Rachel Solomon's program, Transmissions from Satellite 973, airs Thursday mornings 1 to 3 a.m. And Preston Matson's program, Altered Circuitry, airs from 1 to 3 a.m. on Saturday mornings. Both can be heard on WRIRLP 97.3 FM on the dial in the Richmond, Virginia area, or worldwide on www.wrir.org.
There you face the biggest karate kung fu blockbuster of them all. A thunder kick. Sounds like you've never heard. Sights like you've never seen. And a kick like you've never felt before.